This is a Relay Project.
The Discourse starts right now with Cheryl Oates and Erica Baroudes.
Welcome back to The Discourse. It's April, and wildfire season is already underway in Alberta. Evacuation alerts were issued for northern Alberta communities this week. And at the same time, Alberta is facing an escalating water crisis as drought conditions continue to worsen.
Now, many of these natural disasters, you know, are out of government control, but government does have a responsibility and a mandate to respond to emergencies, protect the public, and work proactively to lessen the impacts. Today, we're looking at the current emergencies, storms brewing, or lack thereof storms brewing, in Alberta and the politics of the emergency response.
And of course, we couldn't do an episode without talking about the NDP leadership race, so we'll get to that at the end of the show today. Alberta is no stranger to devastating wildfires. We have been fighting them for forever, though in recent years, not only have the impacts of the fires increased, but the damage is further if you look at the number of hectares burned, and the air is worse if for anyone who's tried to spend time outside over the last couple of summers. And the cost of dealing with all of these emergencies has ballooned, not surprisingly. Given all this, I think it's worth talking about, and I'm sure you have an opinion, Erica, is the province doing enough?
Yeah, and I do want to dig into that. I think it's important in Alberta, actually, fire season starts March 1st. So that we're seeing this in April, no surprises, although like the extreme, I know we'll get into. But one of the other things, and I think we want to throw to a clip right now, is just the what creates a forest fire or what starts a fire, and throw to a clip that from Premier Danielle Smith during last year's election, maybe reason not to have elections in the spring, her response to the wildfires and kind of a message to Albertans. So I'm sure we'll get to unpack that one too.
Human activity causes the vast majority of our wildfires. If we've had 609 wildfires this year, 350 of them so far have been determined to be human caused, 104 caused by lightning, 155 are still under investigation. We make sure that every fire that we do not know the cause of, that we bring in forensic investigators to be able to examine that. We have forensic fire investigators on staff at Alberta Wildfires. And through our national agency, the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Association, we've made an additional request for forest fire investigators along with other labor resources. And this request has been met. We want to make sure that we understand the cause of all fires, and we want to make sure that people understand that when conditions are dry and we're not getting rain, that they have to be very careful when they are out, when they're throwing cigarettes out the window, when they're having campfires. And that is, I think, the overriding message that people need to understand, is that most wildfires are caused by human behavior.
I'll let you go first on her last point. I'm sure you have something.
We just went like straight into it. So firefighters, and now we're into... there's a bunch of early wildfires this year, and we just went straight into, is climate change real? And here we are. You heard from Danielle Smith there, who said, you know, she's making it very clear that a big portion of the wildfires in Alberta are human caused. Not going to disagree with her, but to say the vast majority are caused by human activity, like she's like, there's 600 and 300 and something are caused by human activity and lightning. To me, that's not the vast majority, but I guess we don't have to like dissect the details. I think for me, the point is that yes, we can look and say that wildfire based on forensic evidence was caused by someone throwing a cigarette out the window. But I don't want to discount the impacts of climate change, because the reason we're in such a, we have such dry conditions, the reason we have had dry conditions year after year, I don't think you can deny that some of that is due to climate change.
So I would say, I mean, we've had, and in our political lifetime, I think both of you, and like you and I, or at least myself, go back to like the Slave Lake fires. So you're looking at, you know, almost two decades of this happening. There are seasons that happen regardless. We're in an El Nino year, so, you know, warm, dry winter. Can all relate to this. I can see you smirking for our listeners because you're like, she doesn't think climate change is real. I do. And I
that you got El Nino in there.
I know, because for everyone, I was like, it's El Nino, right, guys? Like, get my talking points in order before the show. But anyways, there is stuff that is setting up this year being different than what we saw the last 2 years. So we're expecting a higher rate of fires this season, but there is actually two things that start forest fires, and I or fires, or like is human beings causing it. Now, I'm not dismissing, you know, the need to address climate change or different hotter conditions or drier conditions, but that's the byproduct. The product that creates it, and so like an environment, but the actual causes are the only thing that actually starts a forest fire is when lightning hits a tree, and when someone creates a man-made fire and it then accelerates. So I want to get that out there that there is actually, and so actually I was interested because I didn't really pick it up because we were in like election mode last year when Premier would have been doing that press conference, and like, okay, so you're listing the numbers. And to be clear, that was from the election. That's not the numbers this year in the clip we played. But like, what are the investigation investigators are really going to say it's either for like lightning or man-made. So like, what are these forensics doing?
But I think it's important because, and first, I don't want to, like, the reason, yes, you can say fires will start no matter what the current drought conditions are. But the truth is that we have had sustained and more severe drought over the last few years. And most experts who study this area would say that that is in some part due to climate change. And so when we have fires start, whether it's through a lightning strike or whether it's through human activity, those fires burn for longer, they're harder to put out, their damage spreads faster, and we have more catastrophic impacts than we would have had otherwise. So that's just, that's a point for me to say, I'm glad that the province cares about this issue. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that firefighting season is underway. I think they have made many missteps along this course. But I would also like to see the province say out loud that climate change is real, that it's caused by human activity, and that in part fighting these natural disasters, we should be fighting climate change. And I don't think they're going to get there.
Well, I think we've talked about conservatives believing in climate change and that it is something. And I think we all know that it's the problem. It's how you get there. And so like, actually, if we're taking a few steps back, a little bit of nerdy context, I think one of the big challenges that we have in from a policy standpoint here is actually how we approach national parks. And just for context, we don't like harvest lumber in national parks. Now that's federal jurisdiction, so there'd have to be some partnerships there. But the problem is that we are blessed with I think it's Lodgepool pine is our provincial, so a little tidbit, our provincial tree. We have a lot of pine. It's very different than BC that has like maple and Douglas fir. So what we're dealing with in Alberta on our landscape is actually a tree that has 60 years and actually does die. So and then catches on fire. I think one of the policies that actually from a federal and provincial standpoint is how do we make sure that we're actually doing and approaching emergency management and how to harvest trees properly in order to try and avoid this, because we also know that pine equals pine beetles and we have all those across our province. So it's kind of inevitable that a lot of areas like Jasper and Banff are going to very much be subjected to a lot of forest fires and more so this year. So that was my little the more you know moment with Erica Prudies.
Thank you. Thank you. For that quick pivot about from whether climate change is real or not straight into
what I'm trying to get out is that like we will see a higher rate than a place that has high precipitation rates and different types of trees, and that like we also have these beautiful national parks, but the downfall is that we don't have policies in place that are actually helping mitigate the potential of forest fire from lighting or people camping in those beautiful areas.
And truthfully, like it's a multi-pronged thing, right? Mm-hmm. And every government can look back at emergency response and say, in hindsight, I would have done X, Y, and Z differently, because truly every situation is unprecedented. But I do think that every government, no matter their stripes, and all governments can do this better, can do more proactively. Like if we are, and we will talk about drought a bit more too, but if we are in a situation where we're looking at prolonged drought, how proactively can we look forward to fighting firefighter season, wildfire season, knowing that now it's not really a season. Like, we're seeing fires burn all through the winter. They're smoldering underground. Like, maybe it's not a season anymore. Maybe proactive thinking is saying, we now have people employed all year round. We're going to recruit and retain them. We're going to give them the benefits that they've been asking for so that people are drawn to Alberta, so that it's not just college students who are off for the summer, and we have a dedicated workforce that is staying here in Alberta and making careers out of fighting wildfires. That's one way we can move forward. And I think we have to start, like, there is a contingency fund, but I mean, I will be shocked if we don't overspend the contingency fund last year. Last year, there was 2.9 dedicated to wildfires and emergencies. And this year we've dedicated 2 million. So I just think we're underspending or underplanning for a growing problem.
And I would agree that, like, you know, my concern is the contingency plan. From what I actually know is that we are seeing forest fires this time, but the province is actually confident that because of the type of year we've had and the potential for a lot of rainfall in June and July, that the 2 million could be enough. However, you know how I feel about this provincial budget. I haven't been shy to say that I don't think it's the most conservative budget.
This isn't really a place to be conservative, though. Like, if you need emergency money, you're going to spend it.
No, but I'm saying it's not. I would want a contingency budget, which is for this exact purpose, to actually be larger than it was because of the potential of, like, why we have good fiscal management, to be able to have that stuff and have a deposit that would be, like, larger than last year, that it would in theory grow. So I would say cut other places to make the contingency bigger, but I'm no longer in a place that matters until I say it on public podcasts.
And I think, like governments are always looking at this in more than one way. One is, of course, like, let's do everything we possibly can to make sure that the resources are in place to protect communities and agricultural land, etc., parks, when there is a wildfire and when we are in the peak of wildfire season, especially in really dry conditions. The other is that during an emergency, there is a lot at stake politically. And, like, I know that sounds crass when we're talking on one hand about preserving livestock and land and people's communities. But on the other hand, like, I mean, on the crass side of it, there is a lot politically at stake. And for governments and for elected officials, how you handle emergencies at the peak of an emergency and how you've handled it leading up to can make or break your political career. And we've seen that in Alberta over and over again, because we've faced floods, we've faced droughts, we've faced catastrophic wildfires. Mm-hmm. And when an elected leader doesn't step up to take control the way that the population expects them to, when they don't understand the frustration or the emotion that the population is dealing with, the population turns against them really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we both have different experiences. I worked for Premier Redford during the Southern Alberta floods. You worked for Premier Rachel Notley when there was the Fort McMurray fires. Maybe I'll ask you first, like, what did you see that, like, was, and I, again, being crass, the opportunity for Rachel Notley in that setting? And then again, like, how it sidetracks you from the government agenda you're actually trying to drive. And I mean, prime example, Premier Danielle Smith had to do it in the middle of an election. It did help to some degree, but it also takes you away from, like, the campaign.
Totally. And when the Fort McMurray fire began, I remember it really clearly, because this is like, in terms of communications, having led communications for that government for 4 years, this is probably the biggest communications piece of my career in that government. And I was partly influenced by my time as a reporter, and actually my time covering Premier Redford when Southern Alberta was experiencing floods. And I remember very clearly, because I was a reporter in Lethbridge and I was sent to Medicine Hat to cover the floods, and the community was so frustrated that they felt like the province didn't care about them, wasn't listening, and that Premier Redford hadn't visited. And I mean, I think that really flipped support for her in Medicine Hat, because they felt like no one cared about them and no one was listening, and the Premier didn't even have the time to come and visit. And I remembered that really clearly the day that the first evacuation notice went out for Fort McMurray. And then that evacuation notice grew by hundreds in seconds. I can't remember exactly how much it went by, but first it was like 200 people evacuated, 400 people evacuated. And I remember looking at my colleague saying, Rachel has to go. Like, as soon as possible, Rachel has to go, so that community knows that she is being briefed on this in real time, that she cares about it, and that she's there. They're her number one priority right now. And I mean, Rachel felt that way too. She got up in a helicopter the next day, in a military helicopter, flew over Fort McMurray, and then went directly to the Provincial Operations Center. And not only is that the right thing to do, but that's what people expect of you as a leader. They expect you to say, I understand this is the scariest moment of your life. You've just driven out of Fort McMurray on the only road with flames in your rearview mirror.
Not even driving, like literally.
Yeah,
like,
you might not see your house
forward.
Again.
Yeah,
you might not see your pets again. Like, I understand what you're going through, and I empathize with you. And I think that's number one, is that people just want to know that you care and that they are your number one priority in that moment.
Yeah, and I'm not gonna like push back on that point. More like, I mean, the different context is it's easier to fly into one place than, I mean, that's all of Southern Alberta, and I mean. Mm-hmm. One of the hardest hit places was Calgary Elbow, which was Alison Redford's home riding. She wasn't close to the river, so it wasn't a personal concern. But all of Calgary, there was high river. And I do hear you. Like, I think one of the biggest things is oddly, your initial response as a leader to an emergency such as this, and like you said, showing the empathy and like showing up for those people, is a significant leadership opportunity. I think Rachel also did a really good job of involving the local MLA, which is Brian Jean and the leader of the opposition. Yeah. Unfortunately, like, he was also having to deal with same thing that everyone else in Fort McMurray was dealing with. But I actually think it showed a good, like, putting down the putting politics aside and coming in. And that was more the initial. I don't know how the rest, but like inside baseball, played out with that. But again, it's a huge leadership opportunity, which is actually why I think that having these all other prairie provinces or Western Canadian provinces have their elections in the fall. So it's actually mm-hmm. weird that, like, I mean, I think it was because when the writ was dropped under Notley and then Kenny making it for 4 years exactly. But it's tough. It's also tough for what we're going to talk about in the drought or agriculture sector to have it in the spring, because again, it did take away from this election. Not going to complain that, because it actually helped Premier Smith, I think, show that empathy and show the travel and mm-hmm. being premier-esque. But again, I don't think that should play into truly an election of who are you voting for. It was just a variable that was added. So there's definitely that. Like,
I don't think it hurts. Like Alberta, you know, has been through a ton of natural disasters and emergencies, and that is terrible. I wish we had fewer, but it also means that the infrastructure that stands up to support provincial emergencies has been through this a number of times. Like the Provincial Operations Center that is up when we have something like a massive flood or a massive fire, they know exactly what they're doing. They know what has worked and what hasn't worked before. And the infrastructure is there should a premier choose to do it. Mm-hmm. And I should also mention COVID. When a premier chooses
Good
to
one.
Do it,
should they choose?
Like Daniel Smith should have been there every day. I mean, the campaign made it tough, but people expect that in those moments where they've been pushed from their homes or whether they're worried they're going to lose their homes, that the leader of the province is there saying, I will be here. I will be sharing information with you. Here's when you can expect the next bit of information. And I'm here with you despite an election all along the way with every mm-hmm. decision you have to make for your family. Well, so
in fairness, they did
totally
put,
interfered.
But
the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think it was. And I would say that there was a government official, Minister Mike Ellis, did basically take that role over. And a lot of times you do see, and I think when both of us were there, the emergency management fell under the Minister of Municipal Affairs. Mm-hmm. I remember, like I said, some of the people that I'll remember from my time in government, many I don't want to remember, but some that I'll remember are the people that were in the operations center with me. I was up in Edmonton for a good chunk. Like you said, you remember that first call and some of your lessons learned that obviously like Rachel was able to respond to. I was at like Tough Mudder and Whistler and had to come home early. and I'll never forget that, like showed up with bruises all down my arms, like so looking so hardcore, but came back and it was like, I was in Premier's comms team or office as well. And it was, yeah, like, what do? We divided. Some of us were in the Edmonton Core Operations Center. I remember flying in a helicopter with Minister Rick Fraser into like Canmore and Banff to do a DRP announcement. Like, there's just things that you and I like will, there's a lot of challenges going into high river, seeing that like firsthand and understanding the impacts is something that I think both of us from our political careers. So hopefully this go around, all of those best practices are applied. But I mean, I look and I want to hear some of your lessons learned. I think our DRP, like the disaster relief program, was kind of a nightmare. And that was in an attempt to get money to people as fast as possible. And it just didn't really work out. But I think that the governments since and those individuals that were on that task force, I think got onboarded to be part of Fort McMurray fires and other responses because they do have those lessons learned. And yeah, there's a lot I think all governments can do or in hindsight can see. And from my understanding, it gets carried forward. So hopefully all lessons learned are applied now.
Yeah, actually, a really interesting one that happened during Fort McMurray was informed by High River and the floods during High River, because Danielle Smith was the MLA for High River at the time. She was sitting in opposition, so she didn't have line of sight into what government was doing to handle the situation. And it put her at a severe disadvantage as the person representing the area. And so lessons learned from that, when the Fort McMurray fire affected Brian Jean's riding, and he was obviously looking to represent his constituents, the Provincial Operations Center just sort of filled us in on the dynamics of that had happened in High River and said, you know, it's your choice how you want to interact with the opposition. And because of that, we brought Brian Jean into a daily briefing. Like he got daily information, he got access to satellite images, anything his team needed, the Provincial Operations Center offered him. And that was, you know, no partisanship aside, he was the MLA for the area. And based on past experiences, we thought that his access was really important.
No, and I would agree that like that was, I think, quite a missed opportunity in the Southern Alberta floods. So like I said, if they can take lessons learned, put politics aside, collaboratively work together. And I think in the case of my nerdy policy suggestion, that also results in some collaboration with the federal government, because we clearly have, you know, we're not the same as BC, and we always say that, but like literally when it comes to like how forest management and our size of our national parks and the types of trees we actually have here, lots to realize that maybe this is a good extending a branch with our relationship with the federal government. Wow. Do you see what I did there? I didn't even write that down. It's just, you know, all up here. Anyways, do you want to change gears to the such a positive, uplifting topics today? Shift over to the drought?
Yeah. Obviously, this increase in wildfire risk and, you know, being where we're at, where we're already seeing evacuations in the wildfire season, despite the season starting in March, like it does feel a bit early. And knowing that we had fires burning all through the winter, it does seem like it's going to be a tough year for firefighters, but also for wildfires. We also have, in conjunction with this, the extremely dry conditions and the risk of severe drought. So that is an emergency in itself.
Yeah. And so something that just happened with the provincial government this, you know, in the last week was this historic move and how they coined it. I mean, it's the first of its kind to have 38 of the largest water licensees in Alberta all come together on a volunteer basis to be able to have a water sharing agreement. And basically what that means for everyone, if you haven't been watching, is that the plan is to reduce their water use if a severe drought conditions materialize this spring, summer. So the individuals involved, like 90% of those in the Bow and Old Man Basin. You got 70% in Red Deer Basin. And it's about a 5-10% reduction that they would have. So the people that are like, oh, I touched that that river, that's where my basin is, it wouldn't impact like the outdoor or indoor water use, or it's supposed to just reduce and not go into a, you know, water emergency where we're you know, significantly reducing. This is a 5-10%. And I actually think it's a really good sign about how municipalities, irrigation districts, industry is all working together to be proactive like that. So I'm sure you have some points that you want to raise.
That was a very diplomatic way to say that.
I'm practicing.
I think it's interesting. I think it's great that the agreement in theory is there. I hope that should we be in a position where we actually need to have people voluntarily reduce their use, that they can or they're willing to, because no one is bound to this. Mm-hmm. This is an agreement to say, should we need to, we will all work together to reduce our usage to make sure that we have enough water to go around. But if situations are dire enough, you can imagine where some water leaseholders wouldn't. They wouldn't be in a position to reduce their water use. So,
but don't you think if you come out publicly and you're like standing there proud, like there's a little bit more pressure than just like a MOU handshake,
but,
you know what I mean?
It's hard to imagine. Yeah, I'm sure. I like in this case, I can't imagine these people, any of the water licensees saying, we're not going to participate, because I think that would look really silly. But we don't know what the future looks like. Mm-hmm. And so if we're in a situation where we really are, like it's every licensee for themselves, who knows how this shakes out and how it works together, because we have a really unique system in Southern Alberta. This isn't a system that you see in most jurisdictions. This is, you know, we don't have a lot of precedent to draw on in terms of how this is implemented. Mm. So I hope it works out. I think it's really interesting, and I think it's good that it's in place now, but worried about how it will play out should we find ourselves in a more catastrophic scenario.
Yeah, so as you instill the fear in all of our listeners, I just want to be a little bit optimistic on one thing that the water or the irrigation districts have been doing is also like looking, and as I mentioned, the last 2 years have been very different than what we're seeing this year. Irrigation districts have actually been backfilling water. So there is some proactive action to plan for something like this. Now, the interesting thing of these emergencies, we can't all just like, you know, pray to Mother Nature or God about like, oh, okay, well, we want rain, because for forest fires, rain is good. At this time of year, rain is actually not good for farmers. Until they put that seed in the ground, they want it to dry up so that they actually can seed. So we're actually in, and this is maybe where Alberta's landscape is very different, is it's almost like in northern Alberta, if we could just have heavy rainfall, but no lightning. And for the rest of our farmers, like, they're not praying for rain right now, and so what it means for what the weather looks like for the next month or two is going to be very impactful to two of our key commodities that we actually have here. You know, from farmers I know, I don't think they're staying up late worrying about this right now. They're actually wanting to just get their seed in the ground and then hope for, you know, that's when they start praying to the water gods of lots of rain in June, July. Again, the traditional way of like El Nino, El Nina years, from what I hear, there's not a lot of concern around what this means for our crops. But as we talked about, we're damned if we do, damned if we don't, because we have forests and agriculture in our beautiful province.
But this isn't like it's not a short-term issue. It's not like, let's hope that we farmers will get their seeds in, let's hope that we get some rain in July and then we'll be fine. The truth is that we've had sustained dry periods for a number of years now. And even if we have rain, even with this last dump of snow that Calgary so begrudgingly got, it's not enough, because there's just no moisture in the soil. So what that means is really, I mean, we don't know. We don't know what the next few years will look like, but that we may have to make longer term contingency plans should we continue to go through a longer period of drought. It just means every year is just a little bit worse because we can't catch up.
Yeah, and I don't, I do think that some longer term policies could benefit. I've recommended one that I'm sure the federal government who listens to this podcast is going to take me up on. but again, like it's what's good policy. There's a reactionary policy that we're seeing. And again, I think 38 water licensees coming together to address that is very symbolic. But you're right. Like, what does this mean from a policy go forward? And we've both experienced it in hindsight, which, I mean, is kind of the best you can do when you're operating in the unknown. But you're right, like, what are we going to do from a forestry perspective? What are we going to do to move forward on being proactive on drought, like besides something like irrigation districts backfilling, because that, like you said, it's we're playing catch up. So I don't know, I guess my question is, like, ideologically, where do we differ on this? And don't say climate change
personally. Like, I just think that you cannot get this stuff right. Like you can hope, you can like sort of do your calculations.
Of conservatives? Like you cannot get this right, anyone?
No, generally, anyone cannot get this right.
Yeah.
No, not you specifically, Erica.
No, I meant like the royal you of like the right.
No, I don't think anyone can get this right. I think if you overswing and you overcompensate saying, you know, we're going to try and make a real difference next year by implementing these policies and they were unnecessary, then people are upset that you've overswung and they've done things that they didn't need to do, or they've incurred costs that they didn't need to incur. If you don't do enough and the implications are much more catastrophic than you had expected, then the onus is on you almost entirely, because, you know, Mother Nature is not accountable to anyone. The onus is on the government almost entirely because they didn't do enough. So truthfully, like a lot of the information from natural disasters or emergencies comes afterward. Like all we can do in the moment is do our absolute best, use all the information we possibly have, agree that climate change is real, and implement policies that hopefully help us move through either scenario in the out years.
If Cheryl and Erica were saving Alberta, we would have the government lead with climate change is real. These are the causes of forest fires. I think the government is actually like really trying to push like the public ownership on reducing the chance of forest fires. Mm-hmm. And then we say the role of government is like primarily a lot of times to react, and hopefully we remove the politics from something like this. But you're right, like ultimately politics does come into it because the government of the day has to deal with this. So I'm also hearing that what you're going to advise your friends on the NDP is like, don't politicize this and scream and shout and fearmonger about people, you know, extreme examples. You're going to be quiet because you just want to work collaboratively with the government on a solution for all. Is that Erica and Cheryl solving Alberta?
I'm sure they will really appreciate it.
Hey, I led with, we're just going to stand and shout and scream climate change is real. So
I just wanted like even a whisper that climate change is real. I feel it would be a step forward. Let's switch gears one more time and finally today talk about the NDP leadership, because the membership deadline has officially passed in the NDP leadership race. The campaign has entered what some would call the persuasion period. So we had all the campaigns really dedicated from the beginning of the campaign until now on selling $10 memberships one person at a time, which is incredibly labor intensive. Mm-hmm. That deadline has now passed. They can't sell any more memberships in terms of those members actually voting in the leadership. So
how many
all five
emails
candidates,
did you get? Or because you're a member, you didn't get a bunch of emails last
night?
No,
I get them from all the candidates.
So I know, but I like, know. Do they still email you?
Yeah.
Some of them are more, I will give credit, and I'm not going to say who, but some campaigns campaign better by saying, we don't have, for example, me, we have you on a record as not having a membership, and texted me and emailed and all of that. Very good tactic. Where others, I think, just did the spray and pray blast of today's the deadline. So there's points to one campaign from me. I'm not going to give them credit, though, yet. They know who they are.
I think, well, I'm excited. I'm interested in what you have to say. I'm excited that all five candidates will be participating in the debates. I have said previously that I think all of these candidates bring really interesting pieces to the discussion in terms of their priorities and what they bring to the debate. So I'm really happy they have all paid the next phase of their $20,000 in fees. And so they'll all be on stage for the debates. And I think that's good for the party. And I think that's good for the membership in terms of holding up ideas to each other.
Yeah, I mean, it'll add to the debate. It'll have different issues or angles being taken. Before I forget, the discourse is presenting a bingo card, but only created by one co-host. Therefore, you don't have to take any hits for stuff I put. But we will be dropping that Thursday, because the first debate's on Thursday at noon. So this show drops, then we have a sweet bingo card, and I'm inspired. I had a lot of content, so I might have one for other debates. But you're right. I think it's... Yeah. Well, you can make one too. I'll just be way nicer.
What kind of prizes will we be offering?
Let's take that offline. Yeah. We'll come back, but do it. So obviously that's a shout out to like and subscribe so that you can get your first access or your printable bingo card for the number one debate or the first debate. But, you know, walk me through I know you and I were texting. It was like, okay, so when do we get the full membership? I think that regardless, it's like probably going to be record members for the NDP. you know, like there's some already good, like exciting wins for your political party that I don't like. But, you know, you do have some successes of like growing your membership, growing awareness. Five candidates equals the potential to sell more than if you only have two, and diversity of thought. Right. Like what are people wanting, the direction people want to take the party, some policies that, you know, if that person doesn't win, they can also fold into the larger party policy, which is also not a bad idea.
Well, membership sales have been amazing so far, anecdotally. Then the party will release an official number in May once they've had time to go through and make sure that everyone is an authentic member.
But question on that. Authentic member. So like if Erica Birdies, who, you know, isn't like a horrible person, buys a membership, but you're like, know who I am, would you cancel my membership? Or is it just like, you know, people that aren't real? Like how does, what does authentic membership mean?
So without going too far into the details, the party has always done this. The party has always looked at sort of vetted memberships. It's not to say if you have previously held a conservative membership, you are now barred from holding an NDP membership.
Because some parties do have that. Some parties do have that where you, it's like, I mean, you cannot hold a, you're not a good member in good standing if that's the case. So
You can have formally supported conservatives and be an NDP member. You cannot join the NDP and vote in the leadership race if you are joining for nefarious purposes.
But how do you decide?
So
that?
If you're, what if like, I just, if like, your social media, one day? If your social media is like, I hate the NDP, the NDP suck.
I don't say that.
Take Back Alberta is amazing. Okay. We're going to take over.
There
the
we
NDP.
Go.
Like, you're probably not going to have your membership go forward.
So what if someone's like, set a year ago when Take Back, like 2 years ago, I guess, Take Back Alberta was like to take back Alberta from Jason Kenney and from COVID shit. But like you haven't posted recently. I know you're not the person. I'm just, it's very subjective of like if they were like in a Facebook group.
Honestly, Erica, it is like a tiny number of people whose memberships are rejected. Despite whatever bluster you see online, there are very few people buying NDP memberships for nefarious purposes. Most people are engaged in the debate. They want a say in who the next leader will be, and they care about what happens in the next election.
Did you get those talking
points? To answer your question.
Talking points from the party? Sounds really good.
I'll give them to them. But I do, like, I the party is going to be the biggest version of the Alberta NDP we've ever seen.
Because it's now the Alberta
Party. So I think that's
party?
Really exciting. What's that?
Is it because it's becoming the Alberta Party one by one?
No. I mean, truthfully, I think this is just building on the fact that Alberta has been moving to a more solidly two-party system for a long time. Like we had the tide sort of change in 2015. Some people thought that the NDP, I'm sure you've said these words, were one and done, that they, you know, we got a surprise election in 2015 and then we were sort of, it was
election.
Over. We did. We lost the last two elections, right? Mm-hmm. But the NDP has remained fiercely competitive. We nearly won the last election in 2023. We won the popular vote in Calgary, won the popular vote in Edmonton. Like no one could possibly say that Alberta is not a two-party system. It is no longer a conservative dynasty. Albertans truly have a choice. And I think when you look at the numbers of the growing people who are not just interested in voting NDP, but are interested in holding a membership in the NDP, mm-hmm. that again is quite telling that this sort of competitive race and this two-party system isn't going anywhere.
And the interesting thing is going to be the debate to see how, because everyone's played pretty nice. There's been some shade thrown at, you know, Nenshi for never announcing anything that he's ever going to do. But he's going to be held accountable, you know, in the debate. It's going to be interesting how those different players and all five of them really position themselves. Like, that's always the cool thing to watch is like where maybe the alliances are mm-hmm. or something like for nerds like us that are like,
I'm so excited to see that, how they play off each other, who agrees mm-hmm. on what, whether like
the bingo someone... card has some of these like shade throwing this happens. It's great.
And I think too, like, it's easy to have sort of like pie in the sky ideas and values about what it is to be Albertan, but mm-hmm. I do think the debates will push candidates a little bit to say, okay, it's fine to say we're going to tackle climate change, but if you don't believe in the carbon tax, how? And that is a reasonable question that most New Democrats will ask.
Yeah.
So I think stuff like that, we will really see who's come to the table with policy chops. Mm-hmm. And as we all know, the NDP deeply cares about that.
Yeah. Well, and I'm actually interested to hear some of the more like visionary policies, because like we do still have 3 years to the next election. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like what if healthcare is solved? What if, well, I just, I don't, I realistically don't think that you can solve a healthcare system in 4 years. So, you know, I'm just saying, like, that's not, I don't think the thing you can run on in the next election, as the UCP. It's going to be like, here's what we've done. Here's the progress we made, but it's, you can't pull a 180 in 4 years. This is a decade of changes needed. So why they need a second mandate to do that. But I think where it's going to be interesting is like, what if some of these things are running on like affordability has shifted significantly? Like, what are they actually going to root stand for? Of like, are they more fiscally prudent? Are they more like farther left? So I think that like it's a tough thing to be in a leadership, to be honest. Like, when,
especially 3 years out.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Like, this timing makes sense for whomever the leader is to be able to get familiar with the role, to be able to go toe to toe with Danielle Smith. But at the same time, it's like, well, what do you really talk about that's not just top of mind, but longer than that?
Yeah. And I think like this is a really good sort of audition for those who have at the forefront of their mind when they choose a leader who can go toe to toe with Danielle Smith, who is one of the most talented political communicators in Canada, and be able to concisely communicate a message and persuade people and get them to nod their heads and compete with the Danielle Smith's ability to do that. This is an audition for that. If you can't do it on the debate stage, you can't do it with Danielle Smith.
Right. And I would say like something like, I'm going to reference Racky again, who I think would have done really well on the debate. I would say she's probably a few years of practice as opposition leader to be able to go toe to toe with Danielle Smith, because I mean, that is the place that Danielle Smith thrives. We saw it last election. And Rachel Notley's pretty good at it too. And it was like still. You know, like, how much are people going to weigh into how are they now or what is their potential? And that's really hard to tell. And unless you're like, oh, well, will they have good caucus relations? Will they understand the rest of Alberta than where they live or something like that? Like, those are all things to consider. It's just really hard to do. But we'll also get more policy as it goes too. So people can make that
connection.
Yeah, and
you'll see like in this race now, because so far, I mean, the candidates have agreed in a lot of things, which is not unlikely in a leadership
like
debate.
Like,
we're all
hugging and
for
like
the same
skipping
party
together. Like,
I love that.
I do, but I think that like the child, like, well, sorry, in an ideal world, that's really nice, but you have to differentiate yourself. You have to figure out what's your hook. Yeah.
I mean, this is the chance for those who are like, the memberships are sold.
You could go as far as a sovereignty act or running on something like that. It worked, but like, I mean, even now it's like from Hoffman to Ganley, I'm like, where are you really different, right? Like, it's, you're all kind of like really lumped together. In debates, you're going to get challenged. So I do think this is like one of the most critical milestones in this NDP leadership. And I'm going to just pour a glass of wine, eat some popcorn, and just have my little bingo sheet out like everyone
and
else
your
should.
Twitter account going.
Yeah, it'll be like rapid response.
Can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Anyways, but with that, the debate's Thursday. We drop. It's like, it's Thursday right now. You get this at 5 a.m. You get, especially if you like and subscribe to X and our Instagram, you'll get your bingo card. And then we got Thursday night. Tonight is debate night. Well, I'm excited because I don't have to actually decide anything and I can just like look for how they interact with each other. But anyways, that is our show. As mentioned, follow us on all socials so you can get your air quotes, the discourses bingo card, which is actually just mine. So Cheryl doesn't have to take any shade for it. And as you know, these suckers drop every Thursday at 5.
Oh, I got it in suckers.
There. These suckers. It's my new exit.
To like and subscribe to these suckers on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
The Discourse is hosted by Cheryl Oates and Erica Baroudis. Follow on Instagram at The Discourse Pod. Subscribe to The Discourse on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.